pupils of different ages that I had experienced and still experience some of my finest moments in love. Then I get a second question, namely this one. Well, after so many years in school, what does it mean to be a good teacher? And then my eyes become more flattering, and I get the same feeling as when Augustine once was asked what time was. Augustine answered, "I know it if you don't ask me about it, but if you ask me about it, I don't know it." This morning, I would like to share with you some of my experiences and reflections on what does it mean to be a good teacher. And let me start just to remind us all about that this profession of ours, in a long historic sense, is a very modern profession. It is connected with the invention of the art of writing, with the art, the invention of the letters, some 3,000 years before Christ. And this decisive step in the history of the human mankind required a group of skilled persons who knew this new art of writing. It made it possible for the first time in history for mankind to forget something without losing the information. And it made it possible to bring a message across long distances without yourself bringing the message. An oral culture was slowly replaced by a written culture, decisive step in the development of human mankind. And the words we use about our profession remind us of this long history. We know that the word school comes from the Greek word skola, which meant free time, spare time, the time when the boys could go to a house and learn the art of writing and reading. And on his way, during the day, and in the skola, this boy, and it was only for boys, was accompanied by the family's slave. His name was pedagogue, coming from the Greek word pais, which means boy, the slave who accompanied the boy. That is the root of the word pedagogue. But the pedagogue had nothing to do with the teaching of writing and reading. He was just accompanying the boy. He was just taking part in the upbringing of the boy. When the boy came to the skola, he met the teacher, the didaktilos, the one who knew the art of writing and reading. And this reminds us of that the role of the teacher today, the role that we have of being one that bring up the children, help in bringing up the children, and teaching the children, in old Greek, that role was split in two parts, the pedagogue and the didaktilos. And we know, all of us, that the status of the teacher through history has changed. It has depended on the political, the economic development in society, as well as on the school's position in society. In Norway, in my country, the glorious age for Norwegian teachers were between 1860 and 1950. Then the teachers were well educated compared to the rest of the population. Education was looked upon as crucial for the industrialization of the society, for development of democracy, for the nation building. The teachers were well organized, their status in society were high, they were political and cultural leaders in the countryside and in the cities. Many Norwegian teachers became ministers in the Norwegian governments in that period. And it was this teacher, well-educated, self-conscious, with a high role in society, who stood the biggest test that Norwegian teachers have ever been put against, namely the test of the Second World War. You know that we in Norway have added one word to the international vocabulary that we are not very proud of, and that word is Quisling. Vidkun Quisling was the leader of the Nazi puppet government in Norway for 5 long years during the Second World War. He wanted to make Norway a fascist state, a classic fascist state. And he knew very well that in order to do that, he had to get hold of the children's minds and souls. And in order to obtain that, he had to go to get hold on the teachers. He had to create a loyal teacher who wanted and who took the responsibility of teaching the Nazi gospel in Norway. But the Norwegian teachers were unwilling to be partners, to become partners in that project. And they said no. They refused to cooperate with Quisling. Then Quisling tried to force them to teach the pupils the new ideology. He closed the schools. All Norwegian schools were closed in the winter of 1942. He arrested approximately 1,000 teachers, sent them to prison camps, to jail in the winter and spring of 1942. But the teachers, most of them, almost unanimously, said still no. We want to be loyal to the parents of the pupils. We want to be loyal to our own conscience. And in the winter of 1942, this fight between the Norwegian teachers and Vidkun Quisling reached the climax. 1,000 teachers arrested, sent to prison camps, 500 of them put on a small vessel in Trondheim and sailed 17 days along the coast to the very northern part of Norway, where they were forced to hard physical work in order to build a fortress against the Soviet Union. But the teachers still said they were in jail and they were put into hard physical work, but they refused Quisling's offer. They stood the test. And this non-violent action paid off. Quisling had to back down. The schools were reopened again, and the teacher could take the job again. And Quisling said in a speech to Norwegian teachers in the summer of 1942, "You have destroyed everything for me in Norway." There were not very many group of people in Norway who received such a testimony by the Minister President of Norway. And on their first day back in school, the teachers in Norway read a statement to their pupils, which really is a marvelous written document. It is a statement about the ethos of being a teacher, and I think it is relevant for any society to any time, where they promised the pupils that they will never teach anything that is against their own conscience and the will of the parents of the pupils. And this non-violent action by the Norwegian teachers was also known outside Norway. In the White House in Washington in the United States, our Norwegian Crown Prince and Crown Princess, Ola and Märtha, had good contact with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And in a great speech on the 16th of September 1942, dealing with the need for and the value of civil disobedience, of civil resistance,
in the occupied countries. Roosevelt said in this speech, among other things, and I quote, "If there still is someone who wonder why this war is fought, look to Norway. And if there still is someone who doubt the will of the democracies to win, I say again, look to Norway." He might have said, look to the Norwegian teachers, because it was the Norwegian teachers who had made him put up and use this rhetoric phrase. After the war, after the Second World War, teachers in all Western societies have met bigger challenges than teachers have met in all ages before. That is what I think. And let me just mention a few of the challenges that teachers in modern societies have met. First of all, a more active state. Education has become a decisive factor in nations' social and cultural development and economic growth. We still remember Tony Blair's repeated formula in Great Britain. What Great Britain needed was education, education, education. New plans, changing curricula, have been introduced at a higher and higher speed in all Western countries. And the philosophy is, in a changing society, we need a changing school. And in a changing school, we need a teacher who is open for change, the challenges from outside. Second, more and more pedagogical experts outside the schools have challenged the teacher at universities, at regional college. Experts that, even though they hardly have ever been in a school teaching themselves, they know exactly what is the best methods of being a teacher. They know exactly what should be done in the classroom, and they have their recent reports from research around the world that they refer to. And very often, these pedagogical experts at universities and regional high schools, they are chosen by the governments, by the state, to be experts in boards, in advising councils, when new educational programs are to be made up. And the teacher is sitting there in the classroom, receiving all the new ideas, written formulas that should be invested in the schools. Third, the teachers had to relate to a new type of children after the Second World War. More active, less obedient, more multicultural, more self-conscious. And the Second World War is the landmark also in that field, because many teachers, writers, psychologists, pedagogues, they said that the tragedy that happened in Europe during the Second World War must partly be explained by the way children had been brought up. The authoritarian upbringing, the obedient child who had never learned to say no, never learned to protest, the authoritarian teacher, the authoritarian school. And many research programs all over Europe after the Second World War tried to investigate into this authoritarian teacher and authoritarian school. If the child is the father of the man, a peaceful world had to start by raising a new child. And there was one book that some of you probably will know that really, in the 1950s, it sold in more copies in the Western world than the Bible did. It was written by an American doctor, Benjamin Spock, and the title of the book was Common Book of Baby Care. It was on the night shelves of all parents, and it told the parents and the teacher how should this new child freer, more liberal, be brought up in Western societies. Fourth, the teacher met better educated and more active parents. The teachers had been the ones that had led the revolution, the educational revolution, all over the Western world. All of a sudden, in the 60s and 70s, the leaders of revolutions, they often become victims of the revolutions themselves. And the teachers sort of became victims of the revolutions. Parents came to school with better education, often, than the teachers had. And they were sitting in front of the classrooms in meeting. They put up their hand, asked difficult questions to the young teacher who was standing there, nervous, trying to answer the questions from these parents who really had taken the place. He had, according to my opinion, taken the place of the priest, because the priest in older days could come into the school, could ask these questions, could take the control. The parents had sort of taken that place. And very often, I think, some teachers, at least in my country, maybe not in yours, the teacher had a feeling of inferiority to these strong parents, the clever parents of the clever children, the curling parents who wanted to sweep the life arena for the children, the trophy parents who kept the children as a trophy in front of them, bringing them into the light. And the teacher should be a helper, an advisor there. Fifth, the teacher in modern societies received less and less support from the surrounding institutions of the schools. In older days, to all ages, the school had stood for the same values, the same attitudes, the same moral commitment as the surrounding institutions in society. In modern times, this role of the school and role of the teacher is challenged. More and more, the school's ethos had become a counterculture against strong trends in society. In the school, the teacher during the day encouraged the pupils to solve conflicts peacefully. At night, the computer play gives license to kill, which is the frame of a special computer play. And number six, the teacher faced a tougher and tougher competition from the media. We all know about this. On every roof, international TV companies put up their begging bowls in order to get the coin of the children's time. There were so many educational arenas, so many teachers outside the schools, so much funny stuff to peep into. And in comparison to most of the things that were on stage in media, school seemed dull and old-fashioned. There were so many attractive things around there. We know, and all research show, that the difference between a good and a bad school is the teachers. Is the teachers. The good teachers. And our challenge is then, well, what should a teacher be in the 21st century? What is the role, really the core elements of being a teacher in the 21st century? And I think that if there is something in the expression by the American writer John Steinbeck, who once said that a great teacher is a great artist, I think that the foundation of our role and our job must be pedagogical freedom. We have to have a pedagogical freedom to frame our job the way we want to frame it. And I have made up some guidelines for myself and for you this morning guidelines for good teachers. And I have these 10 guidelines, not 10 commandments, but 10 guidelines for teachers on this old instrument that some of you may remember. It is called an overhead projector. If you can't use your head, use the overhead. And I'm going to share with you some of my reflections about these 10 guidelines. And these are fairly simple things, because I have a strong feeling that the core thing of being a teacher is about the simple things. But I have to add, as the math teacher once said to his pupils, if you think that this task is easy, just wait till I have explained it on the blackboard. So this will probably be the same way. Okay. The first thing, of course, and I think we should start there. A good teacher should know well and love her subjects. I think this is the foundation for all teaching. There are some who say today that, well, that was probably something that was relevant in old days when the teacher had a monopoly of knowledge. But today, when our pupils can get their stuff in from internet, all the information they need, the teacher should rather be a good coach rather than know a special subject. I don't disagree in the fact that the teacher should be a good coach, but I disagree very much if you say that the teacher shouldn't know her or his subjects very well. Because you can't give advice, you can't be a coach if you don't know how to the landscape you are going to give advice. And if you as teacher don't know and don't love your subject, you should never expect your pupils to be attracted to it. That is the simple law, according to mine. Because the pupils, they meet the subject through their teacher. And the mystery then of the teaching profession is how do we raise the interest of these subjects in the pupils? That is really the big mystery. Because if you aren't able to raise this love of the subject, this curiosity, I don't think that pupils learn anything at all. They may probably learn something for a test in a short-term period, but they really don't learn it, make it a part of their own life. So the simplest, the shortest, and the most important of all pedagogical rules, according to my opinion, was given 1600 years ago by Augustine when he said, nothing is learned which is not loved. You have to love something in order to learn it. And that is the big, big challenge of all the teaching profession. Motivation, concentration, and repetition, that is this part of this teaching process. The second thing is that you can know your subject, you can love your subject, you can be very well prepared for your teaching profession, but a good teacher must have something else. And I really hesitate to write it down, because it may appear in one of these formulas from the Department of Education, and it should never be written there, just in our minds. And it is, you should love your pupils. Why should it never be written in an official document? Because then you must be sure that one day there comes a controller in your school who is going to test and measure and control how much do you love your pupils. And your salaries will be dependent on your love for your pupils. There are so many things in school that can never be measured and must never be measured. And this is one of the things. This is something that can never be demanded by force. It must come from an inner source. And why is this so important? It is so important because when we love our pupils, we see them at their best. We see their strength, not their shortcoming. We see their possibilities, not their limitations. And we know that we are creating each other's in the way that we look at each other's. A pupil being looked upon in a nice way, in a loving way, by her teacher, start probably to love herself and think that I am valuable. I am something that is worth being loved. And it makes me another human being. The third guideline is you should see each pupil and listen to her. And I think that this is one of the things that I personally have been quarreling and working hardest with in my own professional life as a teacher. Because it is not very difficult to see the kind and clever pupils sitting on the front row, those who do their home lessons, who like their work, who are clever, who resemble the teacher maybe in a way. But the hard thing, and you don't need a long university education to be able to do that, but the hard thing that is to see the pupils back there, the pupils that disappear for you in some way. And I remember myself in a lesson when I had my first teaching job in northern Norway, in a small, small school when I was 19 years old. It was my first job after high school. And it was a nice group of pupils in the third grade, 18 pupils. Oh, they were so nice. And this year, 1967-68, it becomes better and better the older I get. But there was one girl in that classroom that I couldn't really see. She was small, she seemed fragile, she was pale, she was almost like a small plant having been put in a cellar, having received too little light, and was now lifted up into the light in the classroom. She was the weakest, the less cleverest girl in that classroom. And she was back there somewhere. She was hiding behind a pupil that was brave and clever and big and took a lot of room in the classroom. And I couldn't really see this girl, this pale girl. And what I knew about her was that she was living with her grandparents. Her mother was unmarried, living in a city nearby, coming home each weekend. And I saw this girl going there, but the 19-year-old teacher neither had the wisdom nor the experience to try to get in contact with her. And that's the way the year passed, till we came to the month of January. And I still remember, after one generation, this lesson in January 1968. It was a lesson about natural sciences. The teacher should teach about butterflies in that lesson. Imagine this. It was right in the mid of winter time, freezing cold in northern Norway. We hadn't seen a butterfly for months. That's the way of picking a subject. And the teacher himself was not a very good expert on butterflies either, I tell you. But I had read what stood in the book, and I was searching on these small boards, paintings with butterflies that we brought with us, and I found two boards, three butterflies on each board. Put those butterflies in front of the pupil in the classroom, and started this with this teacher question. You all know it. No, you probably all wonder about, we say. Very often no one wonders about anything. You probably wonder about what is the name of this butterfly. And I pointed to the butterfly on the top. No one knew the name of the butterfly. The name was written with small letters. It was visible for the teacher, and that was necessary, I tell you. But it was not visible for the ones that were put on the first row, the clever pupils, who said, yes, we know it, teacher, always. When I myself was going to answer my own question, and that's what we often do, isn't it? We ask the question, and we answer the questions. I saw a small hand coming up from the back row. Not like this, but like this. At the back of this tall, big girl. This pale girl called Astrid, raised her hand for the first time in my lessons. And we were in the month of January. And I looked back at her, and all the others changed. They turned their heads and looked back in the classroom, and it became silent. Astrid raised her hand. The miracle has happened. And I said, yes, Astrid, you know it. And there came a low voice. Apollo butterfly. It was an Apollo butterfly. I pointed to the five other butterflies, and Astrid answered all of them. And it was still so silent in the classroom. And I thought that, well, when this lesson is now finished, I have to get in contact with Astrid. I have to speak with her and ask, how did you know this? And when the lesson was over, Astrid came up. Usually she tried to disappear as fast as possible, to get out, not to be seen by the teacher. But after that lesson, she was standing there, a little behind the others. And before I had time to start to ask her the question about how did you know this, she gave me the nicest compliment I have ever received as teacher during my 33 years, and ever will receive, I'm quite sure. She said, she looked up at me, and I still see her there standing one generation after. She looked up at me and said, thank you for seeing me, teacher. Thank you for seeing her hand when she raised her hand, she thought about. And then she told me that the reason why she knew this was that her grandfather's great interest and hobby was butterflies. And they were out, she and him, in summertime. And they had the equipment for catching butterflies. And on the second floor, they kept them in small cages with glass over it. And they had small needles that they fastened the butterflies with. And she was telling about these things. She was talking about these things with me. And she looked up at me. And one of the last things she said was that, and do you know what? She said, no, I said, I don't know what. Do you know what grandfather has told me? No. I don't know what grandfather has told you. He has told me that when he one day passes away, when he one day dies, I am going to inherit the butterflies. And no, it struck me. It was no longer this shy, pale girl standing there in front of us. No, it was the inheritor of the collection of butterflies who told me, who informed the teacher, how it was with the collection of butterflies in that house. And I didn't think about it at that time, but I've thought about it later in life, that what happened during this session was that Astrid herself had become a butterfly. She had been framed in this puppet sitting there. No, Astrid is a weak one. No, she never raises her hand. No, she never does her lessons properly. No, she is not clever. No, she is going all alone. That was Astrid. And that was also the teacher's view of Astrid. And all of a sudden, we found a growing point inside her. And we made an arena outside her where she could stand in front of us and show us, see, I'm also other colors than you have seen. You haven't seen all my colors yet. And this have, for me, been a lifelong reminder of that, Inge, when you go into a classroom, look for Astrid. She is there, somewhere in the classroom, in the back, somewhere. That is where your challenge as a teacher is. You still have some minutes left, haven't we? Yes, yes. I promised 45 minutes and tried to keep it, so we have to speed up. Fourth thing is, be honest and find your own voice. You have always to be honest to your pupils. Don't try to fool your pupils. You will never manage to fool your pupils. And try to find your own voice, because there are so many ways of being a good teacher. You can do, and each one of us can become a good teacher, but only in our own way. Sixth, have expectations to your pupils and to yourself. Expect something from your pupils, expect something from yourself. Not more than they can afford, but not less either. Lack of expectations very often means indifference, carelessness. No, expectations should be a part of being a good teacher. Stimulate curiosity and thirst of knowledge. Stimulate curiosity and thirst of knowledge. That is the motor of all learning. The thirst of knowledge is the only thirst that increases the more we drink. The more we learn, the more we want to learn. And we have to find the pupils where they are in life, where they are in the classroom, and we should try to show them something that they didn't know that they needed. Find them where they are, take them somewhere, and show them something that they didn't know that they needed. Seven, often bring something new to the classroom. We know this, all of us. I do what I did last year. It functioned so well. And I've done this now for 22 years. It functions less and less well, but it's too late now. It's safe and it doesn't require a lot of all these preparations. Old customs die hard. This is dangerous. This is really dangerous for a teacher, because you always have to have the stuff warm. You have to have it here, right now, the things that you prepared last night. Eight, protect and develop good rituals in schools. I am very much in favor of good rituals. The opening of the week, the beginning of the day, the celebration of birthdays and festivals, and UN days, the finishing of good work, good rituals, give the pupils and the rest of the staff a sense of belonging, a sense of feeling connected. They raise the awareness of empathy, of responsibility. Good rituals train pupils to be nice to each other, show regard, show helpfulness, and so on and so forth. Ninth, contribute positively to your colleagues' well-being and growth and building teachers' teams. All good teaching begin in the staff room. Are we behaving the same way to our colleagues as we expect the pupils to behave to each others? With caring, with compassion, with helpfulness, support, solidarity? Or are we competing with each others all the time? Are we going around as smiling killers against each others, envying each others. And my impression, my deepest impression of what a good school is when I come to the staff room and hear laughter. Laughter is the best signal of all about that this is a good staff. Because in order to laugh, you have to feel confident with each other. And number 10, participate in the discussions about the social, cultural, and political role of the school in society. That is the political dimension of being a teacher. Remember that each day there come to this globe 204,000 new inhabitants. They come without luggage, they come without language, they come without morals. In a few years, they are going to be raised as teachers, parents, farmers, officers, politicians. And we are the ones that are going to build this thin surface of civilization. And this surface is really thin. Believe me, we all know it. All Europeans know it, at least. And this surface of civilization, it is not transfused to the blood. It is transfused, it is built every day through the education. Day by day, laborious, toilsome, brick by brick. What we teach and how we teach decide what kind of world we are going to get. So easy and so difficult. And in the UNESCO Constitution, we know that it is formulated like this: since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that peace must be constructed. Peace must be constructed in the minds of men. We are the ones that construct this peace. Education not only about peace, but education for peace. In order to learn democracy, we have to learn it within democratic forms. Otherwise, we don't learn democracy. And I think that we should try, we teachers, we should try to install in the minds of our pupils the same attitude that George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, once formulated like this: you see the world as it is and ask why. I see the world as it should be and ask why not. That is the attitude I think that is needed among children in our schools in the 21st century. Thank you for your attention and good luck in your important work. Thank you.